Let me pray and we'll get started. Father, thanks so much for your word. Thanks for the time that we can have together right now and the freedom that we have to gather and talk about your word so openly. God, I pray that you would use this time today in each one of our hearts. This isn't a time for us to have an intellectual exercise only. It's a time for us to think, but also to let our hearts be impacted by your word, by the things that you want to teach us and help us understand. I pray that we would each be receptive to that and use the things that you teach us today as we live our lives. In Jesus' name, amen. So we're going to be looking at Matthew 5 through 7 this week and next week. What can you tell me about Matthew so far? We've covered the first four chapters. I haven't been in here. Bring me up to date. Bring me up to speed. Remember the context. Why in the world would God choose Matthew to write a gospel? He was a dearly beloved person in Israel, wasn't he, all of his life? I mean, why would God choose him? I'm not expecting that you've done this before, studied this before, but what? Why do you think he would choose Matthew, Levi? If you had to pick from the 12, would he be your first choice to write a letter, to write the story of Jesus to the Jewish community? Any other ideas? If God can change Matthew, one of the most despised of all people in his profession in all of Israel, God can change anybody, sort of that idea. Plus, there's another element to Matthew that I think we probably often forget, and that is that Matthew could not have gotten to be a tax collector without having some degree of resources. Even though he was despised, he was probably a fairly influential person. Probably had some kind of family history, money, and that sort of thing, standing potentially in the community as well. So, despised because of his profession, probably a pretty, he would have had more, probably had more advantages in terms of education and some of those kind of things than a lot of people would have had as well. So we come to this, and just to reiterate what I'm sure you've studied, that he is trying to show the nation of Israel a little bit different picture of Messiah than what they were anticipating. They were anticipating another Judas Maccabeus, someone who had risen up in 168 BC and who had delivered Israel from the power of the Greeks and had given them freedom for about 80 years. They had had freedom from any country for the first time in hundreds of years. And they were looking for that. Does the Old Testament talk about Jesus coming on a horse and delivering the people with the sword? Yeah, it does. It paints that picture. And that's part of who Messiah is, but it's not the whole picture. And so Matthew is trying to show that Jesus is the promised Messiah, even though he didn't ride into town on a horse with a sword. And he meets all the credentials, he meets all the things that we, all the tests that we would have for a Messiah, he meets all of them. So you've looked at his pedigree in the genealogies early on. You've looked at the testimony of God the Father, God the Spirit, that he is Jesus in his baptism, that testimony as well. You've seen him stand up to Satan in chapter 4 in the wilderness deal with him effectively. When we come to chapter 5, in many ways, what we're looking at is what does Jesus stand for? If he was running for office, we would call this his platform. This is what he's all about. This is his message. A king has something that he's all about, something that's really important to him, something that says, this is how I view the kingdom and this is how I'm going to reign over the kingdom. These are sort of the laws of the land if he was a king. And that's sort of what he's laying out in Matthew 5 through 7 is this: these are the things that are really important to me as your king and that I'm going to oversee in my kingdom. Make sense? Okay. Do you think that this is the only time that Jesus taught these things? No. Think about it. If this is what his platform is, if this is what he's all about, he would have taught this over and over and over again. It's somewhat humorous to me at times when I read people who try to somehow take the Sermon on the Mount as they go through the Gospels and make it fit into one time frame. Well, in Luke, it's a little bit different here, but, you know, and they try to, well, Jesus would have taught these things that we see in the Sermon on the Mount over and over and over again in many different contexts, not just one day on the side of a mountain. He would have taught them over and over again. So we would see these things naturally in the Gospels spread throughout his ministry. He would have taught these things because that's what's really important to him. I think that's one of the reasons why the Sermon on the Mount is one of the most often read and studied and written about portions of the New Testament is because it really is the heart and core of Jesus' message, what he was all about. Okay? Any questions? Thoughts? Let's just look into, we're just going to look through the first several verses here of chapter 5 to begin with. It says, when Jesus saw the crowds, he went up on the mountain, and after he sat down, his disciples came to him. He opened his mouth and began to teach them, saying, so here's Jesus. He sees the crowds of people. There are a lot of people. He goes up on the side of this mountain. It probably was more of a foothill kind of a place. When we go to Israel, we'll show you where that most likely took place and everything. We don't know for sure, but traditionally we'll show you some, give you an idea of that. But you'll see it's a place where the sea is real close. It's not a mountain in the sense of 12,000 feet kind of a thing. We're probably looking at probably maybe at the most 500 feet to 1,000, something like that, but pretty short by comparison. He went up there to get away with his disciples so he could teach his disciples. But in doing so, it's obvious that the crowds hear. Look at chapter 7, the end of the sermon. He's speaking to the disciples up on the side of the hill, away from the crowd. Look at verse 28 of chapter 7. When Jesus had finished these words, the disciples were amazed at his teaching. Is that what it says? The crowds. So he's speaking to the disciples up on the side of this hill, but it's the crowds hear everything he's saying to them. They were amazed at his teaching, for he was teaching them as one having authority and not as their scribes. So it's important to realize he's teaching the disciples, but he's doing that in the hearing of the crowds, and the crowds are hearing all this and respond to it when he's all done. So what does he say? Would someone read for us the first 12 verses, or verses 3 through 12, 3 through 12.
Rejoice and be glad, for your reward is great in heaven. For so they persecuted the prophets who were before you.
Very good. And these are known as what? The Beatitudes, okay? The thing that struck me a number of years ago as I studied through the Sermon on the Mount was some of the parallelisms between the Beatitudes and what he covers in the rest of the sermon. And it dawned on me that in many ways the Beatitudes serve as a general outline for where he's going in the whole sermon. Let me break that down for you. What do the first three Beatitudes? Blessed are those who are poor in spirit, those who mourn, and those who are gentle or meek or humble. What do all those have in common? I know it's early in the morning. I'm asking hard questions.
Your position.
Yeah, they have to do with me and what's going on inside of me. Look at the next beatitude. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness. They're looking for something outside of themselves. Okay? Then what do these next three have in common? Blessed are the merciful, blessed are the pure in heart, the harder one to understand, and peacemakers. Yeah, they all have to do with other relationships. When you go through the Sermon on the Mount, chapter 5, verse 21 to the end of the chapter is dealing with the inside of me, who I am. It's dealing with the inner man. When we get to chapter 6, he's talking about, he ends it by saying, but seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, and all these things will be added to you. It's looking for God in religious activity in the early part of chapter 6, and he says that's not what we should do. He's really using chapter 6 to say, seek first his kingdom and his righteousness. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for God and his righteousness, his way of life, in chapter 6. Chapter 7, the first 12 verses, when we get to that, which is the wrap-up of this section of the Sermon on the Mount, it ends with, in verse 12, what does 7:12 say? It sort of is a capstone of the first 12 verses of chapter 7. So what's he dealing with? Relationships, right? So it has to do with how I relate with other people. Chapter 5, the bulk of it is going to deal with me. Chapter 6 is going to deal with finding meaning and purpose outside of me. Chapter 7, the first 12 verses, is going to be dealing with how this impacts my relationships. Make sense at all?
We've also covered the anatomy. I find it interesting when you say it like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We hope and desire for in spiritual formation.
Yeah. Can you expound on that a little bit more? I mean, what you mean by that?
I don't know.
I agree with you. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, the interesting thing is, as we go through this, these first three... Think about a Jewish mindset again, because the crowds, the disciples are all Jewish. The audience, the crowd is all Jewish. Think about their mindset a little bit as Jesus starts the Beatitudes. If a good Jewish rabbi, typical rabbi, was talking about who is going to be blessed by God, would he start off with the first three Beatitudes? Who's going to be blessed by God according to the Jews? Blessed are you, blessed are those who keep the law faithfully. All those kind of things. Jesus doesn't start there. It's really interesting where Jesus starts. Blessed are the poor in spirit. In verse 3. Blessed are the poor in spirit. The word poor there is probably best translated bankrupt. Totally devoid, empty, bankrupt. Blessed are those who in their own spirit are bankrupt. Is that where, do you think that might have surprised some of this Jewish audience a little bit, that that's who God's going to bless? It's a picture in many ways of a person standing there and pulling their pockets inside out and there's nothing there. It's totally empty. In my own spirit, I am totally bankrupt. I've come to the end of anything I can contribute whatsoever. It's interesting to me because he's laying a foundation here, and he doesn't stop there. He goes on to the next one. Blessed are those who mourn. Could someone read for us James chapter 4, verses 6 to 10? While you're turning there to read that, remember Matthew and James were good friends. James wrote James before. He was the half-brother of Jesus. He wrote this before. Matthew wrote his gospel, from all that we can tell. But they served in the church in Jerusalem together. James, with the half-brother of Jesus, replaced the apostle James when he was killed in chapter 12 of Acts. James, the half-brother, takes over. So he's the lead pastor there in the church at Jerusalem that Matthew and the other elders serve in leadership in there. They would have been very close to one another. Matthew would be very familiar with James and what he has written. So, someone read James for us.
But he gives more grace. Therefore it says, God opposes the proud but gives grace to the humble. Submit yourselves, therefore, to God. Resist the devil, and he will flee from you. Draw near to God, and he will draw near to you. Cleanse your hands, you sinners, and purify your hearts, you double-minded. Be wretched and mourn and weep. Let your laughter be turned to mourning, and your joy to gloom. Humble yourselves before the Lord, and he will exalt you.
How does James use the idea of mourning there? mourning about what? Let your laughter be turned into mourning and your joy to gloom. What has he just talked about before that? Okay, I can see where you get that. It's not what I'm thinking about, but yeah, I can see where you get that. Can you read it again? What is he talking about when he talks about be miserable and mourn and weep? Why?
But he gives more grace. Therefore it says, God opposes the proud, but gives grace to the humble. Submit yourselves therefore to God. Resist the devil, and he will flee from you. Draw near to God, and he will draw near to you. Cleanse your hands, you sinners, and purify your hearts, you double-minded. Be wretched and mourn and weep. Let your laughter be turned to mourning and your joy to gloom. Humble yourselves before the Lord, and he will exalt you.
What's the issue that James is dealing with in their life? Pride. He says it's sin. Call it what it is. It ought to make you miserable and mourn and weep when you realize how deeply embedded sin is in your life. You get it? And I think that's what Matthew's talking about here as well, taking from his good friend, relatively close time frame in terms of writing, very likely, and everything. And he is saying, blessed are those who mourn. Blessed are those who are doing what James talked about, who are miserable and mourn and weep because of how they realize how deeply embedded sin is in their life. So the first two Beatitudes are exactly what the Jewish people were expecting, right? Not at all. It's blessed are those who have nothing to offer in their own spirit, who are totally bankrupt in their own spirit. Blessed are those who realize how deeply embedded sin is in their life to the point that it makes them miserable and mourn and weep. And then the third beatitude. Blessed are those who are, your translations probably say different things, meek or humble, gentle. Do you have those words in there? It's most often translated humble throughout the New Testament. And humility, the way that it's used in the New Testament is a proper positioning of myself. I'm so sorry, I got something in my throat. Think about it in this sense. Here is God, and here I am. How do we stack up against each other? God and me. How do we stack? Is that a pretty good estimation of how we stack up to each other? No. That's called pride. Seeing myself more than what I really am in terms of how I stack up. Humility is seeing a proper positioning of myself. It's seeing myself under God in this situation. A proper positioning. He is great and awesome. I am under him. I am less than him. What does James, remember how does James end in 4:10? Humble yourselves, therefore, unto God, and he will exalt you. Realize, you want to deal with pride in your life? First of all, you need to draw near to God. You need to realize you need his help. Even before that, you need to submit to God. By the way, it's interesting in James there, he talks about submit to God and resist the devil. There's no and in between. Those are two separate statements. Submit therefore to God, resist the devil. And the reason for that, grammatically, it leaves us with this, that you're doing one or the other, and if you're doing this one, you're automatically... So if you're submitting to God, you are resisting the devil. If you're resisting God, you're submitting to the devil. We're doing one or the other, okay? Submit, therefore, to God. Resist the devil. Which is it in our lives? Draw near to God. I need to realize I need to come before Him. Is it because He's far away? Is He really gone somewhere? No. He's there all along. He's there waiting. He's saying, I need to come back into His presence. The picture in Revelation is, behold, I stand at the door and knock. I'm here. Will somebody open the door? That's the picture of drawing near to God, coming into His presence because I've been running away from Him. But it goes through that whole process then of realizing how deeply embedded sin is in my life to the point that it makes me miserable and mourn and weep. Humble yourselves, therefore. Put yourself in that proper position, that proper relationship to God, where He is the one in charge and you are not. He is God and you're not. There was a... I'm trying to even remember the name of the movie now. It was a... Brother. Rudy. Any of you ever seen that little movie, Rudy, at all? There's a point in that movie, Rudy, where Rudy is this, as he is described in the movie, as a 5 foot nothing guy who wants to play football at Notre Dame during Notre Dame's heyday. He didn't have grades to get into Notre Dame. He didn't have the ability to play for Notre Dame in football, but he was determined he was going to do that. And he goes to this JC right next to Notre Dame for his first 2 years, trying to get his grades up to where he could possibly get in. And every semester he reapplies to Notre Dame after every semester. So there's four semesters he's applying to Notre Dame. And if you don't get in by the time you start your junior year, which would be as soon as he finishes JC, you can't get in. They won't accept you. And he's at the end of his fourth semester. He has applied his last time he can apply. He's been rejected every time, and he doesn't know what to do. And he's very distraught. He goes into this cathedral kind of a building, and a priest that he has gotten to know comes up to him and says, Rudy, what's going on? And he just says, I don't know what to do. I've done everything I know how to do, and I don't know if I'm going to even get into Notre Dame, let alone be able to play football. And he says, is there anything you can do to help me? To the priest. And the priest makes this statement. He says, Rudy, in all my years of ministry, I've learned two incontrovertible facts. There is a God, and I'm not Him. And that's sort of what Matthew is saying. That's what James is saying. Realize there's a God, and it's not you. It's not you. Okay? You're down here. He is God, you're not. We need to come to that realization. We live in a world today, by the way, as we try to apply this to our own lives, we live in a world today that is doing everything it can to tell you you're up here, how great you are, how wonderful you are. Rick, you're a downer. I mean, you're telling us, I'm telling you biblically, the world is trying to make you believe you are in charge. You are all that matters. You are the most important thing in life. And the reality is, He is. Not me, not you. And I need to keep that in mind. I need to remember that. And He is helping me in all of this. By the way, as we go through the New Testament, what we see is that God is in the process of helping us realize how spiritually bankrupt we are, how deeply embedded sin is in our life to the point that it grieves us and we mourn, and how much He is God and we are not. Have you ever experienced any of those things in your life where you realize how spiritually bankrupt you are, where you realize how deeply embedded sin is in your life and it grieves you, where you get to the point where you realize he's in charge, I'm not. He's working in our lives to do this in our lives, to do it. Now then, what I want to do is look at the rest of chapter 5. We're going to skip the rest of the Beatitudes for the moment because we're going to pick up next week with the rest of the Beatitudes and go through chapters 6 and 7 next week. What I want you to see, look at starting in verse 13. Could someone read 13 through 20?
Same way, let your light shine before others, so that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father who is in heaven. Do not think that I have come to abolish the law or the prophets. I have not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them. For truly I say to you, until heaven and earth pass away, not an iota, not a dot will pass from the law until all is accomplished. Therefore, whoever relaxes one of the least of these commandments and teaches others to do the same, will be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever does them and teaches them will be called great in the kingdom of heaven. For I tell you, unless your righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and Pharisees, you will never enter into the kingdom of heaven.
Okay. Think again who is hearing this message. How well had the Jewish people done at being a light on the hill to the rest of the world? Not very well, had they? Their idea of their faith, of being the chosen ones, they were the frozen chosen. I mean, we're just us three and no more, kind of us four and no more kind of a thing. It's just us. And everybody else is terrible because they're not us. And he says, that's, in my kingdom, that's not the perspective we need to have. In my kingdom, we need to see ourselves as not a light under a bushel like it has been in Israel, but a light on a hill for other people to see and be attracted to. That's in my kingdom, that's what I want. Then he says, because think about, he hasn't addressed the law at all. In all the Beatitudes that we've looked at, nothing we've seen so far has he said, you've got to be a good law keeper. But he says in verse 17, I do not think that I came to abolish the law. I came to fulfill it, to be the fulfillment of it myself. That's what I came to do. I'm coming to be the fulfillment of the law in every way. I'm going to live that perfect life. Interestingly, in verse 19, whoever then annuls one of the least of these, verse 18, truly I say to you, until heaven and earth pass away, not the smallest letter or stroke, yod or tittle should be, shall pass from the law until all is accomplished. This is just an interesting side note of what Jesus is saying. If alpha, beta, the ABCs of Hebrew, and by the way, it goes right to left, the smallest letter in the alphabet is a yod. It's about that size compared to the rest of the letters of the alphabet. Okay? A tittle is not a letter. The other, he says, not a, what are the two words he uses in English? Okay. So this is the yod. The tittle is this little piece right there. It's the extra part of a letter. Interesting. He's saying not one letter or even a portion of a letter that has been written is going to pass away without being fulfilled. It's all going to be fulfilled. All tangled up here in my cord. How much of what is written in the Bible is going to be fulfilled. Every yod and tittle, every letter, down to even every portion of a letter, there is no mistake. It's all going to be fulfilled. I'm not coming to annul it, to say it's null and void. I'm coming to fulfill it, to make sure it is fulfilled. It's all going to be fulfilled. Now, verse 20 is really, really interesting because it's in verse 20 that he begins to deal with how spiritually bankrupt the people are that are hearing this. He's going to begin to deal with how deeply embedded sin is in their life, and he's going to begin to deal with bringing them to who is God and who is not, to this whole area of humility, humbling ourselves before him. Okay, notice what he says in verse 20. For I say to you that unless your righteousness surpasses that of the scribes and Pharisees, you will not enter the kingdom of heaven. Who are the spiritual leaders of the nation? Okay. Who are the ones who believed in the strictest interpretation and following of the law? The Pharisees. And the scribes were basically, we think of those as people who just wrote things down. They're people of letters. They were lawyers who made sure, who studied the law and made sure that the law was accurately interpreted and understood and that sort of thing. Very much studying all of that. And everything. Unless you are more righteous than your spiritual leaders, you're going to go to hell. Okay? So unless you're more righteous than Brad Bell, Shea Sumlin, Jared Rumley, you're going to go to hell. That's what they're hearing. That's exciting. If you're basing your rightness with God on how good you are, he's saying you've got to be better than your spiritual leaders. That's how good you've got to be. Now, in case they don't, and he's building a case all the way through the rest of chapter 5, and then he comes to the last verse. How good do you have to be? He gets real specific. Someone want to read verse 48? How good do you have to be if you want to be good enough for God? Someone read 48. Okay. Thank you. Therefore, you must be perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect. You want to be good enough? Okay. It's all yours. Just be perfect. Well, how perfect? I'm talking about like God in every way. Some people have said, well, that word perfect can also be translated complete. Okay, therefore you must be as complete as God is complete. Does that really take anything away from the message that he's saying here? He's saying you've got to be just like God if you're going to try to be good enough. What does that do to you when you hear that?
You can't do it.
You can't do it. You feel a little bankrupt to be able to do that? Yeah. And it sort of puts you, it sort of helps put us in position who God is and who we are in relationship to him. I'm not good enough. You know, I was a number of years ago, I was in a frat house and we were having a lively discussion. I wasn't teaching. They just invited me to come in. There were about 50 guys in the living room of their frat house. And they were sort of asking me to lead them in a discussion about life and God issues. So I was doing that. And just asking questions. Somebody would say something and I would say, really? That's interesting. Do you agree with that? And I just had them going through this discussion, sort of orchestrating all this. And finally, one guy got really frustrated because their discussion was just going down and down and down and down in terms of anything that they were expecting. It wasn't very exciting because I kept bringing them back to, really, is that really true? If that's true, well, then what about this? If that's true, this has to be true. Do you agree with this? Well, no. And it just kept being empty to them. And finally, one guy just said, well, I just want to know one thing. How good do you have to be to get to heaven? And I said, well, rather than me answer that, could I just give you Jesus' words? And I quoted Matthew 5:48, therefore you must be perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect. You could have heard a pin drop. These 50 rowdy guys. And all of a sudden, this one loudmouth guy says, well, I sure hope there's a plan B. Okay? Do you think that guy was a deep student of Scripture and understand what it meant to be perfect as God is? He didn't have a clue, but he knew whatever it meant, he wasn't there. Okay? Whatever perfect means, being like God in any way whatsoever, no way. I'm not. And I think we all have that sense of understanding. But that is the case that he is building in Matthew 5, 20 through 48, is to show them how bankrupt in their spirit they are, to bring them to the point of realizing how deeply embedded sin is in their life to the point that they'll mourn about it, and to humble them, to bring them back into a proper relationship with God in terms of who is in charge and who's not. Who's the great one and who's not? Does that make sense? So as we go through Matthew 5, let's just keep that in mind. Let's have someone read verses 21 through 26.
Uh-huh. Again, anyone who says to his brother, Raca, is answerable to the Sanhedrin. But anyone who says, you fool, will be in danger of the fire of hell. Therefore, if you are offering your gift at the altar, and there remember that your brother has something against you, leave your gift there in front of the altar. First go and be reconciled to your brother, then come and offer your gift. Settle matters quickly with your adversary, who is taking you to court. Do it while you are still with him on the way, or he may hand you over to the judge, and the judge may hand you over to the officer, and you may be thrown into prison. I tell you the truth, you will not get out until you have paid the last penny.
Okay. Anybody ever thought or called someone a fool? You're going to hell. Okay? Again, this is real exciting stuff, isn't it? I mean, it just really makes you tingle inside of how fun this is and everything. But in Matthew chapter 5, the first three Beatitudes in Matthew chapter 5, it is a downer, and it's a downer on purpose. I mean, he is trying to help us realize who we really are. I'm a good person, we think. I do good things. I'm better than most people I know. I don't make as many mistakes as several people I could point out. We think all this stuff. He says, no, I don't want you to think about you and other people. I want you to think about you and God. I don't want you to think about how you've interpreted the law and everything. I want you to think about what the law actually says. And here's what God's intent is. You've heard it said, your law says you shall not commit murder. That's the Old Testament law. And if you do, you're going to be guilty, have to go to court. You're going to have to go to trial. You're going to be convicted for that if you murder someone. But I'm telling you, here's the spirit. Here's what God says the spirit behind not murdering is. Don't call your neighbor good for nothing. Raca, don't call your friend neighbor good for nothing. Don't call him a fool. Don't even think it. Because if you do, you are guilty already. Well, I didn't kill him. You're guilty already. That is sin. And all sin is punishable by death. Okay? If you sin, you will die. Make sense? He's sort of knocking the stilts. Now, this is only one of five situations he's going to look at in the rest of chapter 5. He just goes, he hits one thing after another after another. Verses 27 through 30. Someone read those? You'll notice a common expression here. That's interesting. You've heard it said you should not commit adultery. We've already established that we're all murderers. Okay. Now then, he's basically saying we're all adulterers. Because who in their heart has not ever lusted? Man or woman? It's a human condition. It's not just a male condition. It's a human condition. He says, if you have, you're guilty of adultery already. You've committed adultery already in your heart and everything. He says, you want to take care of that? You want to be above board? Then every time you're, if you see something and it causes you to lust, cut out your eyes. You know, if we followed this, the entire world would be blind, handless and footless. I mean, the entire world would be. I really get a kick out of reading some of the books on the Sermon on the Mount that talk about the Sermon on the Mount is calling us up how to live life today in chapter 5. And it's like, really? And you just read some of those books sometimes and just look at the gymnastics they have to do to get around, pluck out your eye every time it causes you to lust. I mean, it's like, really? But I think we're missing the point of Jesus here when we try to make this something that's doable, because I think what he's trying to teach us, this is not possible. Why? Because we're bankrupt in our spirit. Sin is deeply embedded in our lives. And we're way out of whack in terms of how we relate to God and how we think of ourselves compared to God. And Jesus is trying to bring all that back into alignment and help them experience what he wants to bless them with in the first three Beatitudes. Blessed are those who are bankrupt in their spirit. I know that. Blessed are those who mourn, who realize how deeply embedded sin is in their life and it grieves them. They mourn over that. And those who are humble, those who have gotten back into that right relationship, right standing with God.
Mm-hmm.
Nope, just stretching? Okay. Verses 31 and 32. Someone want to read those?
The husband said, anyone who divorces his wife must give her a certificate of divorce. But I tell you that anyone who divorces his wife except for marital unfaithfulness causes her to become an adulteress, and anyone who marries the divorced woman commits adultery.
Interesting. So now he's dealing with the whole issue of divorce here, and he says this. You've heard it said, if you're going to send your wife away, you've got to give her a certificate of divorce. But, he says, I say to you that everyone who divorces his wife, except for the reason of unchastity, it's the Greek word porneia. Any form of sexual anything, pornography, that's where we get our word for that, porneia. Any kind of sexual sin at all, he's saying there, makes her commit adultery. That's interesting. So a man divorces his wife And what happens to her? He makes her commit adultery. How does that work? And he goes on and he says, and whoever marries a divorced woman commits adultery. Interesting. I divorce my wife and I'm making her sin. And whoever marries her is sinning, committing adultery. Okay? Why? In that culture particularly, a woman, if you were, unless you're through your family, you were independently wealthy, which was very, very rare. Otherwise, you either in that culture as a woman needed to be in a marriage relationship where you could be supported and that sort of thing, or you became a woman of the street. So if you're going to stay a virtuous woman, you need to get remarried. And in so doing, you're committing adultery. Why? Because that man that divorced you, that's your husband in God's eyes. And now then, you are marrying someone else, having a sexual relationship with someone else who was not your original husband, and therefore that, in God's eyes, is adultery. And the person who's you marry is someone you're having a relationship outside of your original marriage, therefore that's adultery. Sound awfully strict? But he's looking at it in terms of perfection. Okay? There's some very interesting ramifications to all of that, by the way. When we combine this with other things Matthew's going to say later on, and other portions of the New Testament, it gets really interesting, this whole area of divorce, and we don't have time to go into that right now. But the interesting wording here, just to give you a clue, he makes her commit adultery. Same phraseology, this is the Greek language, but in Hebrew, in the book of Deuteronomy, it talks about a man who sees a maid in the field, and he makes her lie with him. Same kind of picture that's being painted there. He makes her lie with him. She is having a sexual relationship. She's being raped. But she is having sex outside of a marriage relationship. Okay? Which is adultery. You know what the punishment, though, in the Old Testament was he has to bear his guilt and hers, and he is stoned to death. She's not. Did she sin in terms of technically? Yes, because she had sex outside of marriage. Was it her choice? No. But the one who made her sin is the one who has to bear the weight of responsibility and guilt for her. So the husband in this situation is making her do something that is sinful, but I believe he's the one who bears the responsibility, the weight of guilt and responsibility for that. Make sense? Okay. But he's, again, making it very difficult. Let me give you a sense of some of the practices of that day. It was not uncommon. There are stories from this period of time, when Matthew's writing this, of priests who were married. Jews were not celibate. Jewish priests were not celibate. They were married. A Jewish priest would go to would give his wife a certificate of divorce, and he would go to a neighboring village, go somewhere on a vacation for a week or so, marry a prostitute for the week that he was there, or however long he was there. At the end of the time, divorce her, go back to his wife and remarry her. So that in the law, he was okay. That was not an uncommon practice. That was commonly known. Those kinds of things would happen. I'm saying priests because even the priests were doing it. Other men were doing it as well. But they were following the law because they never had sex outside of their marriage relationship. Do you think this might put a damper on some of those thoughts in terms of from Jesus' perspective? It does. It really does. Verses 33 through 37. Someone want to read those?
Again, you have heard that it was said to those of old, "You shall not swear falsely, but shall perform to the Lord what you have sworn." But I say to you, do not take an oath at all, either by heaven, for it is the throne of God, or by earth, for it is his footstool, or by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. And do not take an oath by your head, for you cannot make one hair white or black. Let what you say simply be yes or no. Anything more than this comes from evil.
Okay. Let me define evil for you, if I haven't done that already or you haven't dealt with that. In our culture, when he uses that word evil there at the very end, this is evil if you ever say yes and do no, or ever say no and do yes. He said that is evil. That comes out of and is evil. In our culture, we're very Platonic. We tend to follow the Plato's view of good and evil. Plato said that good was an eternal reality, and it was the mind, thinking, reason, logic. And evil was an eternal reality that was the material world, including my physical body and this table, and everything physical was evil. And they were both eternal realities that would always exist, and they were always at war with one another, and they were the opposite, good and evil, that kind of a thing. And we tend to think about it that way. From a biblical point of view, evil is this sense of God is good. If you want to know what good is, biblically, it's God. Anything that God is or anything that God does, including creation, in terms of its original design, is good. That's what good is. Evil is anything that's not good. Anything that's not God or anything that is not according to or exactly consistent with his original design is evil. Okay? Evil is, so anything I do or think or feel or choose that is not exactly like God and his design is evil. Okay? So what he's saying here is, it seems to me, is don't make an oath. In many ways, he's now at this point, this humility, putting us in proper alignment with God. He's been dealing with how bankrupt I am in my spirit and how deeply embedded sin is in my life. Now he's even going one step further and saying, why do you swear by things? I swear by God himself that I'm going to do it. Well, are you God? When we swear or make an oath, do we have complete control over the outcome? I swear that I'm going to go to church services every Sunday for this entire year. Do I have complete control over that? No matter what I swear by, even if it's God himself? No, I don't. In many ways, he's dealing with, I'm not in charge of everything. I can't make an oath or swear something because I don't have control over all the circumstances that will affect that. Somebody else does, and it's not me. When he says, let your yes be yes and your no be no, or if you say yes, mean it, no, don't flip-flop on that. If you say yes, mean yes and do it. Do we always do that? How many of us have ever said, I'm going to do something and then didn't do it? Okay? I hope that everybody is agreeing with me on this. Okay? We all have failed at this once again. So we're failures at keeping our own word, and by calling or on somebody else or something else, it doesn't make it any better because I don't have any control over those circumstances. There's a little bit of the sovereignty of God. He is God and I'm not in these verses that we just read. And again, bringing that alignment back a little bit to where it should be. Verse 38 through 42. Someone want to read those?
You've heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say to you, do not resist the one who is evil. But if anyone slaps you on the right cheek, turn to him the other also. And if anyone would sue you to take your tunic, let him have your cloak as well. And if anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go with him 2 miles. Give to the one who begs from you. Do not refuse the one who would borrow from you.
Okay. What's he talking about here?
Yes, revenge or getting back at people or justice.
Yeah. It's really setting aside all of my rights. How many rights do I have? None. Simple question to bring all this into perspective. How many of you did something to earn or deserve to be born? Nobody. The very life that we have is not something of our own doing in any way whatsoever. So how many rights do I have? None. Now, we think about our culture and everything, and our culture says, oh, that's what life's all about, is you and your rights. You have the right to be happy. You have the right to feel fulfilled. You have the right to pursue your dreams at all costs. You have the right to do that. As bad as it is in our culture, in many ways, it was even more so for the nation of Israel in the sense of you are the chosen people. You have the right to feel superior to everyone else in their mindset. You have the right to all these things, to relate with God, to do all these things. And here he's saying, no, not really. Okay? Not at all. If you want to be like God, he's saying this is the 100% rule to follow. Now, the last one, someone read 43 through 47.
On the evil and the good, and sends rain on the righteous and on the unrighteous. If you love those who love you, what reward will you get? Are not even the tax collectors doing that? And if you greet only your brothers, what are you doing more than others? Do not even pagans do that? Be perfect, therefore, as your heavenly Father is perfect.
Okay. Do you find it a little bit ironic that he says, don't even the tax collectors do that? Matthew writing that? Pretty interesting. Tax collectors and the Gentiles, those who are outside, those who aren't the special people like us, Jews, and everything, even they do that and everything. So again, he's just really bringing all this down. So I think the capstone of all this to me is verse 20 and verse 48 are the bookends, and everything else in between is showing them how impossible verse 20 and verse 48 are. Okay, verse 20 says, unless your righteousness surpasses that of the scribes and the Pharisees, your religious leaders, you're going to go to hell. You will not enter the kingdom of heaven. He concludes How righteous do I have to be then? How righteous are the people who are better than the scribes and the Pharisees? Verse 48, therefore you must be perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect. Unless, he's saying in verse 20 and verse 48, unless you are just like God in every way, you're going to go to hell. That ought to put a damper on things for us. That ought to be discouraging. That ought to be dismaying. That ought to realize how bankrupt we are. It ought to make us realize as we go through this, chapter 5, I'm a murderer. I'm an adulterer. I'm all these things that I've always prided myself in not being compared to other people. But we're all of those things. We are sinners. Sin is so deeply embedded in our lives, we don't even realize what it is and what we're doing. But it's deeply embedded in our lives. And it ought to cause us to mourn and to weep. It ought to grieve us. And he says, it ought to bring us to our knees, humble ourselves. Bring us to our knees. Under God. God, I need your help. I think that's the purpose of 5:20 through 48, is to help them begin to experience what he's talked about in the first three Beatitudes. Not just intellectually understand it, but to personally experience it down deep inside. He is speaking to the core of their being, to their very heart here, trying to bring their heart to a place of humility before God. We talk about in anatomy, being humbly submitted to God. Part of what he's doing here is saying we can't be humbly submitted to God until we stop being humbly submitted to me. And he's trying to take the me out of the equation in 5:20 through 48. I'm not that hot. I'm not that good. I'm not that right in any way whatsoever. Is any of this making sense? Mm-hmm. Yeah. The interesting twist, and we'll pick up next week and go further into it, but I'd like you to read chapter 6 and 7 for next week with this in mind. When he changes to chapter 6, he says, beware of practicing your righteousness before men to be noticed by them. Otherwise, you have your reward, no reward with your Father who is in heaven. And he's going to go through all these acts of righteousness, the three great acts of righteousness that he talks about here, giving to the poor and fasting that he talks about here as well, and praying, these three great acts of righteousness in the Jewish faith. He's going to go through them. He says, that's not where it's at. Picture with me for a second, a person who has truly realized how spiritually bankrupt they are. They've realized in a greater measure than ever before in their life how deeply embedded sin is in their life, and they were totally blind to it before and didn't see it, and it grieves them to see how deeply embedded, how much a part of the fabric of their life it is. It just grieves them, and it brings them to their knees and says, God, I'm bankrupt. I don't have anything to offer. I don't know what to do. Where do we go from there? Where do we go from that point of absolute bankruptcy, grieving, on our knees, begging, because I can't do it. Where do we go from there? Think about it from this vantage point in chapter 6. It's not religion. That's not where you go. It's not going through religious motions and activities. That's not where you go. Okay? So read chapter 6 in light of that, because the first half of the chapter he's saying, don't go to religion. The rest of the chapter he says, here's what you need to do instead. And when we come to chapter 7, the first 12 verses, think about when we are people who are living out those first four Beatitudes, it's going to impact the way we relate in the world. And we'll see that in the last three of those Beatitudes that we looked, the last several Beatitudes, and in chapter 7, verses 1 to 12. The rest of chapter 7, as you read that, he's speaking to his disciples, but in the hearing of this larger audience. And think about it from their vantage point as you read the rest of chapter 7. Well, all of it, but as you read the rest of chapter 7, think about this good Jewish audience hearing the rest of chapter 7 and what it must have sounded like from their perspective. From their vantage point, growing up the way they did. Okay? So next week we'll cover chapter 6 and 7 and wrap up. Any questions, any thoughts at all? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Is it at all fair to what Jesus is doing in the Sermon on the Mount?
In chapter 6?
Chapter 5.
You know, you can draw some things there. I don't think that's the point of the chapter, though. I don't think he's outlining for us a new set of rules of how to live. That's what the Jews would have expected. Tell me what your rules are. Tell me your interpretation of the law and how it applies to us we've got 600 and some laws that we've come up with out of the Ten Commandments and out of the Old Testament. Which ones do you agree with, disagree with? How do you state them? Do you have some new ones for us? That's what they would have expected in terms of his platform, what he's all about. I don't think that's the purpose of it at all. I think there are so many other passages we go to in terms of how to live and everything. No. I don't think he's screwing with their thinking as much as he's trying to give them perspective from God's point of view. They have looked at this thing called faith or this light religion, spirituality, strictly from an over time developed Jewish mentality. And he's saying, that's where this is at. Let me raise you above the clouds and show you from God's perspective what it really is, and see how you measure up then. Think about Paul. In the book of Philippians, Paul, as a Pharisee, unless your righteousness surpasses that of the scribes and the Pharisees, your religious leaders, he refers to himself as a Pharisee, and he says, according to the law, according to Jewish law, I am found blameless. I am perfect according to Jewish law. And Jesus is saying, really? That may be by Jewish law, but it's God's law that is the standard, not this that you've come to adopt. It's this. So, Jacob, I think that, are there good things that are said or the things we can learn and glean from chapter 5 about life? Yes, I do. I really do. I just think that we're missing the point if that's where we focus. And there are some great men who have written some powerful books that say chapter 5 is how we ought to live. It ought to be our goal for how we live and that sort of thing. I understand that, and I respect those men. I just think it's missing the main point of the chapter. The main point of the chapter is to say, according to God's standard, we can't live that way. Okay, not in this lifetime. We will never be able to measure up to God's perfection in this life, in the things that we do in this lifetime. Is the debt paid for and are we all right with God? Yes, that is true as believers. All that's been taken care of. Sin is no longer the issue that has been paid for and everything. But I think what he's saying here is the spiritual journey that we go on starts with spiritual bankruptcy, not with how good I am. I think that's the main point that he's making here. Speaking to a people who prided themselves in how much better, how much more moral, and I can even take you to Jewish theology today that will tell you the Jewish people are the most moral people in the world. We are gooder than any other group of people in the world. Okay? And they prided themselves in that. They still do, many of them. And we're the most moral race of people in the world. And everything. And Jesus says, that's not good enough. That's not good enough. Okay? Any other questions? Good question, by the way.
Maybe it's just the language we use, like you say, that we can't do it on our own. And does it seem kind of hard to understand that, like, we're held accountable for something that we couldn't even attain to?
Held accountable? What do you mean?
I mean, we're held accountable because we can't achieve perfection. Mm-hmm. But it seems like it's a little bit hard to understand. Like, we're at fault because we didn't do something that we couldn't even do on our own.
Yeah. Was it fair and just of God in the garden to say, if you eat of the tree, you will die? Did he give them other options? Mm-hmm. Did they have to do it?
No.
And we are of their seed. Let me ask you this. My dad I used to say my dad was a hard worker. My dad was a workaholic. He really was. And I was born into that kind of a family with those kind of genes. And I became that for a long time, early in my life, and everything. Is that fair? Let me get even more to the point. Why is it when I go to the doctor, I've got a doctor's appointment tomorrow for my annual physical. When I go in there, the doctor is going to ask me, what's the first thing he's going to ask me to fill out a form about? My family history. Why? Why? Yeah. Is that fair? Why is it fair that... I have an unbelievably low cholesterol level, even though I haven't really, in times past, taken care of myself. When I weighed more than 50 pounds more than I do right now and was totally out of shape, and I had an incredibly low cholesterol level. A good friend of mine who has been an athlete all of his life, he was a college quarterback, he runs every day, he eats to perfection, and he's had 3 stents put in before he was 35 years old because his cholesterol level is through the roof, thanks to his father. There is not a man in his family who's lived past 40 until him because of that. Is that fair? It's reality. It's reality. And sin is the same way. We are born into that. We can talk about the fairness or not fairness about us. It's reality of something we were born into. It was fair for our ancestors who made the wrong choice. It was not fair of them, our ancestors, Adam and Eve, to make the choice they did and pass it on to us. But in terms of God, yeah, it's very fair. He said, these are the rules, this is the impact, and our ancestors chose something different. The interesting thing, though, is as we look at this, as we look at the Sermon on the Mount, he's saying, even though it doesn't feel right, even though it may be, it feels very unfair, God has done something about it. The guy in the frat house was not far off. He was not exactly right. But there is a sense in which there is a plan B. God has made a provision for us to have an alternative to the punishment that we deserve. But we need to not forget we do deserve the punishment. By the way, You'll get into this more when you get next semester with Shay in the book of Romans. But the gospel, when we talk about the gospel, so often we talk about, we start the gospel with God loves you and has a wonderful plan for your life. That's probably the most quoted beginning to the gospel in the world today. God loves you and has a wonderful plan for your life. Is that true? Yes. But that is not where the gospel begins. Look at where the gospel begins, because the book of Romans, in many ways, is Paul's presentation of the gospel in its fullest sense. He'll tell you in chapter 1, verses 16 and 17, I am not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of God unto salvation to everyone who believes. And then he spells out that gospel he's not ashamed of in the rest of the book, what it is and the implications of it in our lives. And it starts in verse 18, the wrath of God is revealed against all mankind because even though we knew who God was, we did not honor him as God or give thanks. Instead, we pursued our own way. We rebelled against him. That's where the gospel begins. The gospel begins with, we are spiritually bankrupt. Sin is deeply embedded in our lives, and we are helpless as human beings to do anything about it. And it ought to grieve us. It ought to bring us to our knees. That's where the gospel begins. Make sense? Again, I know this is a downer to end in chapter 5 and to do all this, but you know, sometimes it's important for us to understand the text. And Jesus didn't want them to just understand it intellectually, but to have to live with it a little bit. How spiritually bankrupt do you realize you are in your own strength and ability? How much do you realize that sin is deeply embedded in your life? You really realize, does it grieve you in your life? Has it brought you to your knees feeling helpless and hopeless before God? Because that's where true spiritual life, the adventure of the Christian life, that's where it begins, is getting the me out of my spiritual life. Getting rid of that stuff so that this can start taking place and I can start seeking him. That's the fourth beatitude. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for God and his kind of life, for they shall be satisfied. Got it? If I'm full of myself and the world, I'm not going to be very hungry and thirsty for God and his kind of life. So, okay. Any other questions, any other thoughts? I'm not sure. Did I answer your question somewhat?
Yeah, I can talk to you later.
Okay. Sorry. Okay. So reach 6 and 7 for next week. Think about it from that vantage point and everything. Would someone pray us out of here? Someone do that?